All right, we're going to go ahead and get started. Good morning, I'm Tim Anderson, the Global Pharmaceutical Analyst at Sanford Bernstein. Pleased to have Roche with us, joining our conference today. Our session today will be with Severin Schwan, who's the Chief Executive Officer. It's a role he's held since 2008. He's been with Roche for quite a long time, since 1993. He's going to start off by making a few prepared remarks using a short slide deck, probably on the order of 10 minutes or so, and then we'll launch into fireside chat. I want to remind you that on the table, you'll see question cards. If you have questions, fill them in, and someone will collect them. Try to write legibly if you can. That's the only request. And with that, let me turn it over to you, Severin.
Thank you, Tim. Pleasure to be back in New York. For Roche, we are at a really critical and exciting moment with a big transition in our portfolio, with biosimilars entering on the one hand and new medicines coming through the portfolio on the other one hand. So today, I'd really like to focus on the rejuvenation of our portfolio and the progress we make with our new launches. Shortly, performance update. You know the numbers. We have been growing in the mid-single digits over the last quarter. Perhaps importantly here is that the new products, as you see them on this slide, already account for $8 billion of sales, 20% of our turnover, and importantly, already account for 80% of our growth, and this will certainly accelerate as we go forward. Operating profit margins, free cash flow margins remain strong compared to our peers. And with this, let me get into the exciting part, into the portfolio. So for us, it's really, if you like, two categories. On the one hand, we have biosimilars entering, and it's about replacing the existing business for medicines like MabThera, Rituxan, Herceptin, Avastin above all, but also Lucentis and Tamiflu. And on the other hand, we are entering new areas in multiple sclerosis or hemophilia, also a number of CNS diseases. So let's start with hematology, with MabThera, CD20s, which have become the backbone of treatments, hematological treatments. As you know, we have one, if you like, immediate successor of MabThera, which is Gazyva, which works along the same pathway and principles. And this medicine has, in the meantime, been launched for CLL, and very importantly, we got the approval now towards the end of last year in indolent NHL, which should open up this opportunity for Gazyva, both in the United States and the European Union. What might be a bit overlooked here is the potential of new medicines we are entering here. One is Venclexta, which we developed together with AbbVie, and the other one is polatuzumab. So we have presented first data for polatuzumab vedotin. We will present additional data at ASCO, and that really has the potential to make a significant change in the most aggressive form of lymphoma. Venclexta is already launched in a specific form of CLL and is being developed for a number of indications of blood cancer. Both of the medicines got FDA and breakthrough therapy designation by the FDA, and polatuzumab recently also got the so-called PRIME designation. That's an accelerated approval path forward for the European Union. Now, let me shift to Herceptin. Here, of course, the story is a lot about Perjeta. You know that we are now entering early breast cancer. Perjeta is already very well penetrated in the later stage lines of HER2-positive breast cancer, when the breast cancer has started to spread. And the reception in the market is very good. We see double-digit growth of Perjeta, which already has a run rate well over $2 billion US dollars a year. On top of it here, we are also looking at opportunities in triple-negative breast cancer. You know, that is a form of breast cancer with an enormous medical need. We have a trial with Tecentriq, our cancer immunotherapy, reading out, and we have another potential opportunity in this field with the Bortezomib, here the jury is still out. We will see how the data read out. If they are positive, then this would be a very nice opportunity given the medical need in the field. Now, talking about oncology, perhaps just as a reminder, Alecensa is doing extremely well. You have seen the data for ALK-positive lung cancer. There's just no doubt this will be the new standard of care. Much bigger opportunity than we would have originally thought based on stunning data. And finally, a word around cancer immunotherapies. We're heading for ASCO. That will certainly be the topic there. Within cancer immunotherapy, it's a lot about first-line lung cancer. Now, I'd just like to say and re-emphasize that we have 5 trials reading out in lung cancer, and 3 of them have already read out positively. IMpower 150 is a trial where we use Tecentriq with Avastin. What we have seen now with the positive data of IMpower 130, if you look at the different subpopulations, actually these combinations are really different. It just shows again that it's not all the same, and it shows that cross-trial comparison is extremely difficult if it's not really the same regime. In this respect, the IMpower 132 trial will be very important because this is really the trial which is best comparable to the respective trial from Merck for Keytruda, where they reported positive results in first-line lung cancer. So we'll see how this reads out. But what we do see is, if you combine it with Avastin, it has completely different properties. So for example, what we have seen is very, very good data for patients with liver mets. You're not surprised knowing that Avastin works particularly well for these kind of subpopulations, EGFR, ALK mutations, for example, also works well for PD-L1 low expressors, and this is truly different to what we see with competitors' medicines. Now, for the sake of time, let me quickly go on with the other franchises. Ophthalmology, Lucentis and later on Regeneron's Eylea have made a huge difference, of course, for AMD. But what is really interesting to see is how much the medical benefit for those medicines depends on compliance, on whether you regularly get your injection into the eyes. And you can see here data which compare efficacy over time between different countries, and actually it's pretty good in the UK on the one hand, and you see a miserable performance here in Italy where people lose vision, and the simple reason why they lose it is because they don't take the medicine in a compliant manner. And that, of course, has a lot to do with administration because you get an injection into the eye. So what are we doing here? We are developing a port solution, which is an insert, a little device into the eye, which allows you to give a Lucentis in a highly concentrated form. And as a result of it, you can dose it much, much less frequently. So we will present data on that or expect data for that in the second half of the year, and that could make a real difference, not only in terms of convenience for the patients, obviously, but also in terms of medical outcomes. The second avenue we take here is with a bispecific, where we combine the VEGF inhibitor arm of Lucentis with a second arm, Ang2, we have seen encouraging phase 2 data, so that's why we have now moved this molecule into late-stage development. If this is confirmed, of course, that would be a real game-changer where we put the therapy to a new level. Now, going into the new franchises, keep it short with Ocrevus. I mean, it is clearly much above not only external, but also, I should say, internal expectations. Keeps roaring in the United States. Obviously, this is due to efficacy, but it's increasingly due to safety. Now, we have almost 50,000 patients on Ocrevus, haven't had a single related PML case. This is not only best in class in terms of efficacy, but increasingly also in terms of safety, and the penetration is accordingly. You see here after 1 year already 70% market share in the United States. That's without any doubt one of the best launches in the pharmaceutical industry ever. And for us, the question was really, can we replicate this success outside of the United States? And the key country here is Germany, because it's the first country where you can launch innovative medicines. And it's the same story. You know, we already raised our expectations, but we again, are far beyond our internal projections for Ocrevus, also outside the United States. So this is really going well. Hemlibra, you have seen the recent data with Haven 3 and Haven 4. More than we would have thought. Originally, the ambition would have been as good as factor 8. Now what we see is that it's not only reducing bleeds by over 90%, very, very importantly, if we compare the prophylaxis use of Hemlibra versus factor 8, we see over 60% improvement in bleeding rates versus factor 8. So what that means is that Hemlibra does not only have a convenience advantage for patients due to the less frequent dosing. With Haven 4, it's now once monthly, subcutaneous. But on top of it, we see improved efficacy. So it couldn't have been better. Now, whilst Hemlibra, of course, this year is a small, much more limited opportunity, as it is only launched for the inhibitor segment, that gives us confidence that we can start to penetrate the non-inhibitor segment as of next year, awaiting U.S. approval for the non-inhibitor segment still this year. So let me perhaps summarize. If I look at my personal confidence level and how it has developed over the last 6 months, it's all gone into the right direction. The main reason for that is certainly the success of the new product launches. But it is also very much about the late-stage pipeline, which has evolved nicely. And I dare to say that we never had a stronger late-stage pipeline than we have today. And not all of these medicines will make it, but some of them have transformative characters. So with a bit of luck, we should not only be able to grow through this transition when biosimilars come in, if one or two of those work, we could get to a completely new level. So on this positive note, Tim, I suggest we go directly into our discussion.
All right. Sounds good.
Thank you.
I thought we could start off with some high-level questions first. So if I had to ask you what excites you the most, you'd probably say what's in the pipeline, which is a great thing. But let me ask the question, what worries you the most when you look forward over the next 5 years, let's say, and answer that from a Roche-specific standpoint and then kind of a broader industry-wide standpoint? What kind of keeps you up at night and
Yeah, it's the other side of it. I mean, you're absolutely right. I think the key success factor for the future is the pipeline. But on the other hand, the biggest worry is if the pipeline doesn't evolve and if trials fail. So I believe in the long term it is all about differentiation. And I would rate that, you know, by factors higher than threats along pricing, for example, because it's directly linked. If you have a truly differentiated medicine and you have a patent protection for such a medicine, then you are automatically also in a very strong pricing negotiation position, no matter where you are in the world.
I think if I look at Roche's stock, the stock has struggled for the last few years, this year as well, and there's been various downgrades. And the big concern, if you ask investors, it's not really that the pipeline isn't going to deliver, because you've got a great long-term track record, you've got a great near-term track record, and you have lots of stuff in phase three. So the concern that most investors would bring up as their biggest concern would be biosimilars. Right. And just the erosion on three of the big products that you guys have. But you don't cite that as your top worry. You cite, the pipeline maybe not delivering, but I think there's probably, pretty high confidence that you guys are going to continue to be a great R&D company.
I see your point. And there's no doubt that there's a hangover on our stock with the biosimilars. And I recognize that. But the reality is, I've kind of written it off in my own mind. For me, there is no doubt that the biosimilars will enter, and there's no doubt that we will have a heavy impact. We see it in the European Union already with MabThera. I have no doubt in my mind that this will continue with Herceptin and Avastin eventually. And even though we have now some windfall because the biosimilar for MabThera in the US is delayed, eventually, next year, it will come, and it will come aggressively. So, for me, this is kind of ticked. We have lost exclusivity. As such, we will have the respective impact of biosimilars, and that's built into the plans. So I'm over that, if you like. For me, it's all about can we replace and extend with new medicines. That's what keeps me up at night. Biosimilars... you are right, of course, will be a topic over the coming years as we gradually lose the sales for, in particular, the three big products. But from a strategy point of view, it's done. It's not my business anymore.
So let's just stay on that line of questioning, and we'll certainly spend time on things that are growing and what's in the pipeline. But if I think one of the concerns is for investors and analysts is not really knowing how to model the impact of biosimilars. And if I look at what we've kind of assumed would happen in Europe and what's played out over the last four quarters and the rate of erosion of your first big product there, it's been faster than what I think most people have expected. I think four quarters in, your sales in Europe for Rituxan were down 44%. Big step down. And the question is, what's the next quarter going to be? And what's a year out going to be? Do you think that rate of erosion is artificially inflated and it's going to moderate?
No. I mean, you're right that in particular quarter three last year, a number of investors were surprised about the fast onset. I have to say it was exactly according to our internal plans. And expect that to continue. I think and I should say from a societal point of view, there should be an impact. I mean, we claim that we earn a premium on innovation and demand patents for a certain time, but the other side of the coin is when you lose exclusivity, it's the only way how our system is sustainable, that generics and biosimilars come in. So the impact will be hefty, full stop. And that's planned. That is part of our plans. And the only way how we will overcome this is by bringing differentiated medicines to patients. That's the only way. If you start believing that you can somehow hang on to the old stuff, you're out of business. So for your spreadsheets, put in aggressive plans for biosimilars. and then listen to my words, that we will still grow through the period. And that gives you then, the other way around, the confidence I have started to, and we as an organization have started to build around our portfolio. And that is important. Biosimilars is history. I know it's not yet history, and we will still have the entry in the U.S. from an operational point of view, but from a strategic point of view, it's history.
In Europe, at least with a product like Rituxan, you know, you do have the sub-Q formulation that I think some folks thought would offer some protection.
Which it does, and it the impact has not been 100%. And it has been different along different markets. And one of the differentiation is, of course, sub-Q. And actually, that might be even more important for Herceptin because the sub-Q penetration for Herceptin is higher than for MabThera. But then again, there is probably even more entrance for Herceptin than for MabThera in a relatively short period of time. So I wouldn't start arguing that the erosion curve of Herceptin is slower than MabThera. With the competition, we get there. It's to be pretty steep as well. So it gives some protection, but only so much.
Yeah. And then in the U.S., if you look at what the experience has been with the first product to face biosimilar competition, a non-Roche drug, you know, it's been fairly tame. What I tell investors is I think you can basically ignore this early precedent. And it's not reflective of what the world's going to look like in the U.S. 1 and 2 and 3 years
that's
from now.
That's also my view.
So that's your view. That's
the completely safe assumption. Share your view.
Okay, so you talked about growing through this period.
Right.
So let's just define what that means exactly. Are you talking about top line growth? Are you talking about earnings growth? Are you talking about margin growth?
No, what I'm talking about is really top line growth. And then, of course, we also have to manage the margins. But when I talk about growing, what I mean is really top line. Replacing the sales beyond what we lose from biosimilars. That's what I'm talking about. In terms of bottom line, if you look at the last couple of years, margins have been pretty stable, and we could grow operating profit in line with sales, but not beyond that. Now, this year, of course, we have the additional impact from the U.S. tax reform, and we have guided the market accordingly. As far as next year is concerned, there's one factor which comes in, and this is the loss of the Kabili patents. So we have a revenue stream at the moment from royalties, and we know the Kabili patents will run out at the end of this year, so we will have to digest that next year. But then again, we are working on our productivity across the various functions, in the back office, of course, to start with. We have a lot going on in the manufacturing network, really massive change there. Of course, we are restructuring our sales forces. We have had already a lot going on in Europe, but there's more to come, and there's more to come in the U.S. as the portfolio shifts. And of course, we also have to constantly look at productivity in research and development. So it's really something across the value chain. And we'll see where we come out next year for 2019. And we'll give the guidance as usual at the beginning of next year. But in the medium longer term, it's clear the bottom line in our industry is very much related to the top line and to the quality and the differentiation we offer with our medicines.
So if you look out over the course of, let's say, 5 years, then you think that revenues are going to grow across that period.
Yes.
And you think margins, at worst, would be flat across that period?
I wouldn't give a guidance over 5 years, but I would formulate it like that. If we continue to launch differentiated medicines like an Ocrevus, like a Hemlibra, like an Alecensa, those products will provide the same level of gross margin than we have seen with our legacy portfolio, Herceptin, yeah. Matera, et cetera. So that should also enable us to keep the margins high. Now, you know, whether we can even extend margins eventually will depend really on the products we get through. I mean, if you dream for a moment together with me and the autism drug, for example, makes it, we have now moved it into phase 3 based on positive phase 2 data. Just dream for a second that this makes it to the market. Clearly, this is a margin expansion opportunity. If you dream for a moment with me and the VGF Eng2 in ophthalmology gives real differentiation over the current standard of care, you know, this market is open for us. I mean, we will replace Lucentis, Eylea, and the Avastin use for AMD. And it's all ours, worldwide. Of course, that would be a margin expansion opportunity. Good, Alzheimer, we know, is very high risk, but let's assume we have success in this field. So, and all of that is going to happen or not going to happen within the next 5 years. So from what I see today, I would say we have a good chance with, you know, the more tangible opportunities like Hemlibra, Ocrevus, et cetera, to grow. That should also give us the opportunity to keep margins in a high, reasonable range. But what I would say is there's this optionality on top. If one of those other opportunities work out, that would just get us into a new game, if you like, and that would, of course, be fantastic for patients, but would also have immediate economic and commercial impact for us.
So, if you know, you could look at the dream scenario from another way, right? Instead of a pleasant dream, you have kind of a bad dream. So, if the pipeline, let's say, kind of falls short, mm-hmm. then you would have to assume, I guess, in about a similar period that there would be contraction.
In the meantime, of course, this risk has mitigated a lot. I agree with you. We still, of course, have the risk that Alzheimer doesn't work, that autism doesn't work, even that hunting doesn't work, that VGF Eng2 doesn't work. I mean, of course, there's a scenario where all of them fail. That's true. But in the meantime, of course, we have... during this period where the biosimilar entry and the respective erosion takes place, here now we have much more data than we had half a year ago. And if you look at an Alecensa, we have the data now. You know, there's no discussion anymore. If you look at a Perjeta, we have the data now. There's no discussion anymore. It's huge growth potential still. If you look at Hemlibra, we have the data now. We didn't have them only half a year ago, especially now the efficacy data versus factor 8 prophylaxis. We have certainty now. The one where there is still uncertainty around is the cancer immunotherapies, because here still a lot of trials are reading out with our medicines, Tecentriq and the various combinations. And the same is true for competitors. So here the jury is out. There is uncertainty around that field. There's no doubt upside and potential downside. But overall, what has happened over the last couple of months was really a de-risking during this phase where the biosimilars are coming in. And that's also why I have started to talk about growing through the biosimilar transition time. What you are addressing is the longer term outlook. And that, of course, can go into all directions depending on how the portfolio evolves.
So can you give us a little more info on the ability to take cost out of the system? Talking with industry folks in the U.S., my understanding is that you've started to pull levers and there's been some pretty big across-the-board reductions in certain business functions, even on the Genentech side. Which is in response, I think, to some of these challenges that you're facing today. My sense when I look at Roche and a few other drug companies that I cover is that there are probably a lot of costs that you could take out of the company if you wanted to, if you needed to. So can you talk about kind of what the vision is there,
right.
and And part of that discussion, too, is thinking about Genentech. So Genentech, when you guys acquired Genentech, intentionally essentially left it alone in South San Francisco, operates well, but there is duplicative overlap. You kind of have duplicative functions between what you have in Basel and South San Francisco. And most of the time in mergers, you would see consolidation. We haven't seen any consolidation of PRED and GRED. Is that something that's in the cards as a cost savings opportunity?
No. Over my dead body. I should also say that the integration of Genentech was a very differentiated integration. So what you are absolutely right is we left research and early development alone. The organization which we call GRED today, it's an autonomous unit, like PRED is in Basel. But when it comes to everything else, then we integrated it. Now, in the first phase back then, there was a lot of functions which just closed down because we didn't need them anymore. As part of the global group. Then there was a reverse takeover of the whole distribution and marketing organization. So this was completely merged in the United States. It's one organization today. And then the global functions were globalized. So late stage development and global marketing was put together. I'd like to say that. So even though for research and early development, you're absolutely right, we preserved the structure, the culture, and everything around it. As far as the other functions were concerned, there was a lot of consolidation. And part of that consolidation actually happened in San Francisco. So global development, for example, is led out of San Francisco. No way that we would give up our diversified structure which we have in research. I think this is part of our secret sauce. That's the reason why we have the pipeline I presented here. I'm totally convinced if you would put that together under one leadership, if you would start to streamline this in some form or shape, we would lose a lot of what our culture is about. We would lose a lot of diversity of thinking. And eventually, it would be very harmful for our company in terms of innovation. Now, that doesn't mean that you still work on productivity. So there are some areas where we are, and I take your point, not productive yet. I can give you also very specific examples in terms of data management. So for us, we are working, for example, to build databases which enable common systems across the different research units. And there is an efficiency element to that, but there is also a productivity element to it because you can better share the data. We talk a lot these days about real-world data from the outside world. You know, it starts with sharing your own data, your own clinical trial data, before you can start working together with real-world data from the outside. And actually, we do both in parallel. It's an example of where you can drive efficiency without in any way taking away the independence and the independence in decision-making of those three hubs which we have with Chugai, and the GRED and PRED organization. This will not change.
So if you're cutting cost or likely to cut cost over the next couple of years, out of which business functions are those costs coming? Is it
number one,
back office? Or
that's certainly an important area where we can improve productivity. For example, procurement. We are putting more focus now into this area. You could argue, should we have done it earlier? Perhaps. But it is an area where we see potential to get efficiencies in a more global scale. So back office is one of the areas. But I would say the probably more material areas is manufacturing. We have a lot underway to rearrange our footprint. A lot was also driven by the portfolio, the shift from small molecules to large molecules, but this goes beyond that. There's a lot of opportunities to make our network more efficient. We're selling off sites as part of that as well. And then I would also say, perhaps part of it might be kind of straight cost savings as such, but there's also opportunities to get much more efficient and productive in development. And I think this is an area where intelligent trial designs play in. That's also an area where we, I believe, can leverage real-world data in a completely different way. It has a lot of potential here in terms of how we work together with regulatory authorities around the world. So there are substantial productivity opportunities, I would say, across the value chain, in particular in manufacturing and development.
Uh-huh. Okay, so how does M&A figure into the future for Roche? When I look at what you guys do with your cash, you don't do many buybacks. Part of that's because of the structure of the company. You pay out a lot of dividends at a healthy rate, so you actually have a lot of cash already earmarked for that. So what do you do with the rest of the cash, right? So yeah. How, when you think about M&A, when you're talking about, you see Roche growing over a five-year period on revenues, is that just the organic business? Does that assume some level of M&A?
Yeah, in my mind, M&A and capital structure is completely independent. Now, of course, your balance sheet determines of how much you could digest. That's clear. But put this aside, I think the decision to go for an M&A target or not, I think should be completely independent on what your balance sheet looks like. For me, the starting point for an M&A transaction is, can I generate value by doing that? And I'm very simple-minded here. My philosophy is you should get at least the money back which you invest in the first place. This is increasingly difficult. There are only a few later-stage opportunities around anyway, and we typically would not be able to make the economics work, and that's why you have hardly seen us doing any bigger transactions. So it simply doesn't work out because of the economics, and it has nothing to do with the balance sheet. We could have afforded many of those transactions, but we didn't do them because they didn't make sense in itself, because we felt we couldn't generate value with those. And if I then read in the newspaper, when then some companies write, yeah, this acquisition is accretive, I can only shake my head. I mean, when interests are so low, I mean, how can you not be accretive? The real question is, do you get the cash back which you invest in the first place? So I'm very skeptical about larger M&A transactions. I think the likelihood of this is very, very low. The last one we did is Intermune a couple of years ago. But what we do is we continue to invest into early stage assets. And here it's a completely different ballgame, because if you talk with smaller biotech companies, academic institutions, etc., of course you have to deliver a certain upfront payment to keep the liquidity of this organization, but it's not so much about the money. It is much, much more about, do you get the medicine or the molecule to the next inflection point? And if your partner believes that you can add something here because you have expertise, access, etc., then you have a possibility to create value together for both companies. It's a very different story than late-stage assets, which is typically a pure bidding process on price. So to come back to your question, I think given the prices we see in the market, very unlikely that we see any larger M&A transaction. We will remain very active for early stage assets. It is unrelated to the balance sheet structure. And if we have not enough leverage anymore on the balance sheet, you know, we have defined it in this range of 0 to 15% of net debt relative to assets. I'm sure we'll find ways to give the money back to shareholders, and typically we would do that with dividends.
So staying on M&A for a minute, when I look at valuations across, let's just say, biopharma, the eye-popping valuations tend to be in that smaller or mid-cap range. But when I look at big targets in biopharma, you can actually make much more of a value case, at least relative to the small and mid-cap stocks. Mm-hmm. So there might be other reasons to be negative or cautious on doing a big deal, structural challenges and integration. But right. Isn't that true? Like when you look at some of these bigger target companies, that they're not actually expensive.
Yeah, that is true because it's true for small mid-sized companies. If we look at the value and if we see what is priced, we are literally talking about factors of difference of what we would say is an underlying fundamental value, and that is certainly true to not comparable to big companies. Now, I know we have shied away from these mega mergers more than other companies, and I think it comes back to what the culture and what the principal model of Roche is, which is so much about cutting-edge science, innovation, etc. So I think for us the integration risks are higher. If you take an approach where you say, well, I make it a cost play, you know, I work on the cost synergies, I take in the assets, I market them, I milk them, whatever, and I reduce the cost base as of day one, and I justify my case with cost synergies. I can see an argument and I can see a logic, but that is something which typically would not work for Roche. Because for us it is so much about innovation, so much about science, that the risks of such an approach are higher, because the disruption which goes along with this approach is that R&D productivity suffers. And then we would start to kind of cut into something which is the heart and soul of what this company is about. And we would lose so much, which we would hardly be able to compensate by some cost synergies. And that's why we have never done this in the past. And that's why I don't see this as an option for the future. But I can see other companies who play on the cost synergies. I can see that. But it's not something we would consider.
And just from where you sit, again, kind of a higher level question, when you look out across the big pharma peer set and you look at what's going on with R&D productivity and you look at what's going on in pricing and that sort of thing, do you think that we're going to see industry consolidation, meaning big pharma to big pharma tie-ups, not for Roche necessarily, but for other companies?
Could happen. I could see that, yes. We have seen it over the past. I think this will continue. But I should also say in the innovative space, that's different to generics. I mean, in generics, we have seen consolidation and ever more consolidation. And there is hardly any room for small companies. You know, if you don't have a certain scale, you're basically out of business. But this is different in the innovative field. I think there will always be smaller companies who come with some really good innovative approaches, and they always have the potential to suddenly also get bigger or to drive innovation out of nothing without scale. So I think there will always be big companies and smaller mid-sized companies. I don't think a fundamental structural change here. But I would agree, as companies get into difficulties, cannot justify their structures anymore, that can also be a reason for consolidation to take place. Not our strategy, but I can see that.
Is there any tangible buzz that we're on the precipice of seeing industry consolidation, or is it just kind of the same speculation about this as always, as it was a year ago or 2 years ago?
I don't see something specific changing here. I think it's the same level of speculation and activity level which we have seen for the last years.
When I look at pharma companies over time, it kind of ebbs and flows whether they take a diversified approach into other business lines or whether they narrow their focus and go back to the core drug business. And the trend among most of the companies I cover has been the latter, to get out of non-core, non-pharma businesses. Mm-hmm. So Roche only has one division that would fit that description, which is the diagnostic side. Mm-hmm. My guess is that when you get asked about possibly separating that out, your answer is probably over your dead body.
Yeah, we know each other very well in the meantime. The reason has nothing to do with diversification and portfolio strategy. The reason is very simply about following the science and following where you know, the medical community takes us, and that comes back to our model of driving personalized healthcare, precision medicine. I mean, we have been pioneer to drive this model, and that had two reasons. One was our traditional strength in oncology, which is a very heterogeneous disease, and this disease offers itself for stratification and targeted medicines. And the second element was that we had diagnostics in-house. So we brought the respective capabilities together and tried to leverage the synergies. And it was a lot about companion diagnostics. Ventana was part of this strategy, remember. We brought them explicitly to be able to develop companion diagnostics for solid tumors in oncology. And that played out well. I think this still holds true for the future. However, there is now a third component coming in from a strategic point of view, and that is real-world data. That's a new dimension which is opening up. If I look at the strategic positioning of Roche over the next 5-10 years, what I see as evolving is from a company where it was a lot about the synergies from a very high-level strategic positioning, a lot about the synergies between pharma and diagnostics and companion diagnostics, it's evolving from a, if you like, bilateral relationship to a triangular where we have pharma and diagnostics and now adding this data management component. And you've seen us active on that front with Flatiron, for example, which we bought out earlier this year. We have this strategic collaboration with FMI. We have literally dozens of collaborations now in this field to build up the partnerships and also our internal capabilities. So from a very high level, if I look at this question of focused versus non-focused, etc., the approach we take is less diversification or not diversification. It is where science and medicine leading us? How do we have the best chance to develop good healthcare solutions? And we believe it's this combination which gives us a competitive edge.
Can we talk about immuno-oncology for a minute? So you flag this as, if I heard you right, you know, kind of uncertain what the growth potential is going to be for Roche. Mm-hmm. And that's because it's a competitive field and it's ever-evolving and it's a landscape that continues to shift. So when I look at Roche, I mean, you guys really deserve a lot of credit for being the first to pioneer this idea of chemo combo. Mm-hmm. So guys like Ira Melman and others that really put forth this idea when there was a lot of skepticism. So far, you guys have been proven right in that. Mm-hmm. But it must be frustrating because you've been beaten to the punch a little bit by Merck, who now is kind of dominating, at least in lung cancer, with chemo combo. So what do you see is kind of happening? I guess the question that comes up is, there's a lag between where Roche is and where Bristol and Merck already are. Is that lag still small enough such that you think that Roche can catch up effectively and become a dominant player? Or is the more likely outcome going to be when it comes to these, you know, third-generation drugs and later iterations of immuno-oncology, that's going to be where Roche shines? Because I think you can, again, I would say you do better science than everybody else.
Right.
So maybe it's down the road. Right, yeah. Where you really,
so the way we look at it is really in three waves. And in this first wave, we were late. I mean, BMS first was first, now they are second, but first was first. And Merck was second, now they are first. But we were certainly third. And the goal in this first wave, and we are from a market point of view, we are still in this first phase, was to just get to the market. And that was the strategy around Tecentriq. It was a very focused strategy. We skipped melanoma and other cancer types because we said we are just too late. There's no way that we can catch up there. So let's focus, take a focused approach, and we went for bladder cancer and second-line lung cancer. And I think that was successful, but this is by definition a very limited opportunity. So now Tecentriq is on the market in a very limited segment. But we have kind of achieved what we wanted to achieve in this first wave. Now the second wave was combinations with Tecentriq, and thank you for the credit with the chemotherapy combinations. Indeed, that played out well for all the companies who went into this direction. And I should say, yes, Keytruda now has, of course, an advantage because they're already on the market. They are already approved in first-line lung, and now they have delivered, they have not received the approval yet, but they have delivered positive results with 189, I think it is, right? So we are a bit in a catch-up mode here, but I think we are really in the race. And I should say that in particular after 130 now, because this is, you know, getting much closer to be comparable to the Merck data. The 150 is a completely different regime, which works better in certain cases and not so good in other cases. But this combination is getting much closer. And then, of course, the 132 trial will be very important, which comes, in not too far distance as well. So I think as far as first-line lung cancer is concerned, yes, Keytruda is ahead here. But depending on how the trials read out, in particular the 132, now with more confidence because of the 130, we could well be back. The other element with Tecentriq, there is, of course, other opportunities with triple-negative cancer. It's more risky. We'll see how this plays out. That is an upside opportunity in my view. And that's kind of it. Then we get into the third wave, and that's where we talk about the new molecules. And here I would say, in terms of the breadth and the depth of our portfolio, I would argue we are, among the leaders, if not in the lead. But this is earlier, and the data still have to read out. So, Merck is ahead, no doubt. I think the jury is still out for lung cancer, and then we'll see what happens with the new molecules.
I want to ask you one maybe final question as we're coming on the top of the hour. So Hemlibra, very novel, cutting-edge science, makes a big difference in the lives of hemophilia patients. I know commercially you're just still in the early stages of rolling out. Mm. Last year when we had you at this conference, and it was also the final question back then, we kind of asked you how big you thought a product like this could be. Right. And you described it as something along the lines of, if we get to a few billion in sales, that would be a successful product. Yes. For us. So now that you've seen data out of Haven 1 and Haven 3 and Haven 2 and other data sets, are you still thinking that's the ultimate size of a product like that, or could it be something much bigger?
The next level would be double-digit billions, I guess, right? I don't see that. But when I said it could be a few billions, now I'm getting increasingly certain about that potential. Let me put it like this, because the inhibitor segment, of course, is tiny. That is a starting point. That's the entry. The big question always was, how big is the opportunity to get into the non-inhibitor segment? That was the big question. And, it was this balance of, on the one hand, you have much better convenience, but there is kind of decades of safety history for the factor VIII around. So how quick will the adoption be? Because if you are in a chronic disease like hemophilia, you don't want to risk your life with a new medicine. So that was really the question, how fast is the adoption? I'm now more confident about that because, first of all, we see that the safety profile is doing very fine. All the cases we had were unrelated to Hemlibra, so there's an increasing safety base now. Now with Haven 3 and Haven 4, of course, we have a medical advantage versus factor VIII. So who had that on the radar screen? That we have, with prophylactic use of Hemlibra, we have a 60%+ advantage versus prophylaxis with factor VIII. So that could actually be a paradigm shift in how this disease is going to be treated. And as such, I'm very confident that this is now a several billions opportunity.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. We're out of time.
Thank you.
Really appreciate the time today.
Tim, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Carl.